Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Government Investigation. I'm your host, Al Scott. A Dallas police officer finds herself on the wrong side of the law today. The incident started last Thursday night, shortly after 10 p.m., when the off-duty police officer made a call to dispatch. Robert?
Yes, sir.
How are you doing?
How y'all doing? I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I'm gonna let you go into the events of what happened last Thursday and where we are today. And after we finish the issue in Dallas, Texas, we'll go to Shreveport, Louisiana, where we're going to speak with a gentleman who is running for city council. Robert, what went wrong last Thursday night?
Well, from what we know, from what's been made public, you had a Dallas police officer. I think her name was Amber Geiger, something like that. This woman, she came to her apartment complex, but once she got there, things went a little bit array because from her story, she's saying that she walked up to what she thought was her apartment. Some accounts say that she thought said the door was ajar. Some accounts say that she tried to get in with her key. Witnesses say that they heard her beating on the door to try to get in, but it turns out she was at the wrong apartment. Somehow the door was open, and the gentleman whose apartment that it was wound up getting shot. Amber gave her statement. They gave her 3 days later, and even though this happened in Dallas County, she turned herself in, I guess, in Geiger County. I forget what county it was, but she turned herself into a jail one county over. Since then, there have been numerous of inconsistencies in her story, where she literally changed her story two or three times since her original statement. This is a big issue because, you know, you have an innocent man who was murdered, and you have a police officer who's basically lying about some of the aspects of the investigation. So really, other than that, we don't really have any more information to release. Although you and I did a couple of shows, and I have my opinions about the subject. It wasn't as cut and dry as she or either the powers that be would like us to think it was.
Well, yes, Robert, this story has went international. I have a lot of red flags that pop up when I read the story. And for one, when she did a 12-hour shift, this is what the police said at first. She was working a 12-hour shift. Hours later, they said, no, she was working a 15-hour shift, so she may have been somewhat confused when she got home because of a long day's work. Well, I totally disagree with that because I know how police officers are trained. And also, she wasn't confused when she left the police station, retrieved her belongings, got into her vehicle, and made it to the apartment complex. She wasn't confused then. I might would buy some of her story if she had pulled up at the wrong apartment complex, but she knew exactly where she lived. She also knew that she didn't live on the fourth floor. She's on the third floor, but she parked on the fourth floor. So why did she do that? Well, it don't take a rocket scientist to figure out Officer Geiger and Bachman, Jean, somehow had a relationship with one another because she knew exactly where she was. Here's the thing. The police are now lying to her. The woman alleges, I put the key into the door and it didn't open. Okay, well, that's to tell you either something's wrong with the electronic key card or you may not be at your own apartment. Then there's a bright half-shaped red rug in front of Mr. Jean's door. She don't have a rug in front of her door. Well, she's now beating on the door, and she's saying, open up, open up. But who in the hell are you saying open up to if this is your apartment and there's nobody in there? Then the statement changes again. Well, no. She said, no, the door was ajar. It was open a little bit. Well, those are some heavy doors. That's not how it works. When it closes all the way. Now, I go into an apartment that's pitch dark, but I can see someone moving, and I give them commands. This is a part of her story that changed sometime yesterday. I think it came out. She was giving him verbal commands, and he did not comply to any of her commands. Well, first of all, I know that's a lie, but if that had been the case, you don't have to comply with any of your demands. You're inside of his apartment. He lives there. You have no reason to be up in there. So the story continues to change. Every day, Robert, there's something new to her story. And with all due respect, I believe her story, like I believe the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan has a dream of his white daughter saying I do to a black man. This thing has so many holes in it. It's like you're watching a lifetime movie. She changes her story every day. Every day there's something new. She wasn't that confused when she got to the right apartment, Robert. So somewhere down the line, something happened, and she forgot where she was at. So after she shoots the guy, then she cuts the light on. Oh, Lord, this is not my apartment. Really. I just don't buy it. And the last thing he said to her was, why you do this? Why you do this? Well, that kind of lets me know that he know her. He know her.
Yeah.
Now, if the door was unlocked again, if the door was ajar, why are you saying, open the door, open the door, let me in? Well, just walk on up in there.
Yeah.
And it's funny, the neighbors heard her, and two new witnesses came out yesterday, Robert, you and I talked about that. The neighbors heard her saying, open the door, in a police tone. But nobody heard her give him verbal commands to follow.
Yeah. Well, it's strange, I'm of the opinion that there had to be a some type of relationship. Was it nothing more than a real close friendship? They knew each other. She's saying that they didn't. Well, of course, she's going to say that to cover herself. Now, maybe the police are covering for her because they found out that she was involved in a relationship. But I believe she's being coached by certain entities as what to say to try to get her story to line up as close as they need it to for when it goes to court. But the district attorney there is trying to actually increase the charges. So it's a lot, you know, a lot of what we're saying is just speculation. But, you know, you just look at things in common sense, man. A lot of times common sense is the best sense. It's best, you know, that's the best research you can do is just search your brain for what does not add up. And you always got to ask questions. But we're going to start asking James some questions now. And I'll just sit back and defer the floor over to you.
Thank you, Robert. I totally agree with you on that. It is no secret that crime rate in Shreveport, Louisiana is on the rise. There's probably two or three shootings a week now, and it's been out of control for a while. I do believe there's a crisis in the city of Shreveport. However, Mayor Arlie Tyler says not. The chief of police, he says not. Mayor Arlie Tyler once held a news conference. I think it was shortly before she announced that she was going to be re-election. She made a news conference where she downplayed the statistics. She said violent crime went down in the city of Shreveport. Well, I don't know what city of Shreveport she's talking about, but the one that I live in, where I'm from, it's not happening. The violent crime is on the rise. We even have police officers being fired, police officers being arrested, so it's like the whole city is just out of control. And it's election. And it's time for some people to come up out of their seats who've been sitting there doing something close to nothing. And had a gentleman on your show recently, and I think he was on, KMJJ a couple of weeks ago. I hope I got the station right. But I'm honored to have him on the show with us today. When I sent him an email asking him to come on the show, he said absolutely. And I'm glad he's here today. I just hope I don't mess up his last name. We're going to welcome right now James Costison to the show. Good afternoon, James.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
You are welcome. I guess the first question I have for you, as I'm sure my listeners does, is will you give us a little background on who James is, ways being, ways that ways he's trying to go?
Just a little background. I'm sorry, there's a little reverb. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All
right. Well, my name is James Carstensen. I'm running for 314 Council District B. I am currently the elected chairman of the Cadet Parish Executive Committee for the Libertarian Party. And I'm also on the board of directors of the Highland Restoration Association. I'm a single dad of all girls, you know, and I'm a resident, you know, of the city lifelong. I was actually born in Lynn home, grew up on West 75th Street, you know, where died in Highland now. I'm really running. I know, I think you quoted me about, you know, trying to bring back some common sense to City Hall.
Right.
That really is a big part of it. You know, that I'm trying to generate some citizen engagement.
Okay, so is this your first time running for public office?
I'm sorry. There's really no reverb. I can't hear.
Yes, yeah. Somebody has a TV or something up too loud because there's a bad reverb going on. I think it's
no, that was
okay.
Me. I had I had this phone hooked up to the speaker because it's on charge. But yeah, I'm here
okay,
now.
Okay, all right. Oh, now we can hear.
That's much better.
My question.
All right.
Yeah,
what was
again,
your question,
James, is this your first time running for public office?
Yes, sir. The seat that I hold now is not actual. You know, it's not government. It is a committee. So while I was nominated and elected at a caucus, it was not a state organized election. Something like what a city council would be.
Okay. Okay. Well, I guess we'll just cut through the chase and get right at the questions then. So, we open up by talking about the crime in Shreveport, and right now the overall crime rate is 66% higher than the average of crime committed in the state of Louisiana. It is 126% higher than the national average. When you were on the Real News Behind the News show with Robert Thomas, I've watched that video and I'll also pose the question to you, and I'm gonna pose it to you here. Do you think that this current administration has done or is doing enough to deal with the crime in Shreveport?
Absolutely not. That's the same answer I gave there. And I know you'd like me to elaborate on that a little bit better. But, I mean, it's an absolutely not. This current administration has spent more time deflecting, you know, accusing its citizens of being stupid and uninformed. And, you know, the routine, you know, perception is reality. And, you know, the statements that, you know, we need to get our facts straight and, you know, repeatedly beat over the head that the citizens are stupid. What they have failed to do, obviously it's an election season, so, you know, this administration is suddenly far more visible than it has been for the last 3.5 years.
Exactly.
But they refuse to acknowledge the fact that with the new police chief that they put in place, that there was many things that were actually very good. I'm actually happy that they implemented a lot of this, which was essentially they changed police policy on how they would engage suspects. Whereas before, you know, they could just, you know, round people up. A couple of guys loitering outside of a gas station or standing at a street corner would be enough to where some, you know, officer could approach them, shake them down, you know, and if somebody's got weed in their pockets or an illegal gun, you know, they're picking up. So you generate a lot more crimes by, but the problem was that, you know, it created an opportunity to maybe let bad cops do bad things, you know, and target certain demographics more than others, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. So those things were good. So those have brought down crime tremendously overall. Your overall amount of crimes going down and down and down, that's one thing that is playing down to reducing the crime, is that we have less, you know, young black men walking down the street, let's just be real, that are going to be harassed by the police and, you know, basically search to find something that they can, you know, pin them on, or if they are doing something, you know, which, you know, like weed in your pocket, I mean, that's a victimless crime.
Right.
But it's something that there was a whole lot more risk. The things we're really concerned with is violent crime. Violent crime is at an all-time high, even as bad as it was in 1988, you know, and we had our most amount of murders. We don't adjust for the improvements of our we now have A-plus rated trauma center at LSU Medical Center and some of the best hospitals in the country here that are able to keep these people alive. We have way more people getting shot and surviving. You know, we had 56 people killed last year, but how many of those people were shot? And
right.
Trauma kits that the police carry now, the training that they have, that have been credited with saving, you know, a conservative estimate of almost 200 lives in less than 3 years. So, I mean, let's roughly, you know, add 60 to that number. Well, now you've got 106 murders compared to a all-time high in 1993, excuse me. In 1993, there was 88 murders, all right? We would be looking at, in 2017, could have easily been over 100 if not for the improvements in the medical thing. That's another way that, you know, violent crime is being misconstrued. And then the other aspect is, due to social media, people having access to information much faster, and then the obvious politicized and in the intentional divisiveness that comes along with the media that portrays this image, there's not a lot of people in poverty, especially people of color, aren't as trusting to the police anymore. So they're not even calling the cops. You know, there's crime is handled a little differently in the neighborhood that I grew up in. You don't call the cops. You know, there's all of those things play into a statistical number being used against us so that they can say that crime is down, when in fact violent crime is at an all-time high. All-time high.
James, you know what? I gratefully appreciate your honesty, because not many candidates would come out like that. But that's something that I can really appreciate. And I know Robert has some questions for you, and I just have two more that I want to ask you. Businesses are leaving, and businesses won't come. Residents are moving, some just over the bridge. What would be the reason for that, you think?
Well, it's far easier to move to Bossier. You know, there's that whole stigma that Bossier don't play. You always hear them talking about. So there's this, you know, belief that it's just outright safer over there, which may or may not be completely true. But as far as their government is concerned and their city council, they incentivize these new businesses. Their new downtown development that they're doing, and their old downtown where they, you know, rebuilt everything, you know, open container laws and allowing family age, you know, 18 and up to come in, and they're generating this and tying it in with the casinos and a local brewery and restaurants, and they're bringing everything that is, you know, music and food, which are the best things that we have to offer, really. You know, our cultural diversity here in the Shreveport-Bossier area is really unmatched almost anywhere in the country. And we have some of the best food, the best music, these venues. These are things that Bossier City is proactively, they're not just talking about it, they're doing it. They are limiting regulations and making it easier for businesses, new businesses, to start and to open up and to grow from within. They're not out there, if they're trying to lure anybody from out of town, they're trying to lure people from Shreveport to say, hey, come on over here. Your business will be safer. You're less likely to be robbed on this side of the river. And they'll give them their tax abatements and whatnot. And I have a personal friend who moved a business from Shreveport to Bossier into that establishment, and his explanation was they called me. They lobbied me. They worked with me. They actually helped him to get his place built, you know, modified and set up in the process. It wasn't like it is in Shreveport where everything is a bunch of hurdles, and if you're not in the club, then your stuff's not getting approved. You know, in Shreveport, if you're in the group and you know the right people, hey, great, it's a rubber stamp process. But that doesn't happen for, you know, the other 190,000 of us, you know, struggling day to day, working two or three jobs per household just to be broke.
One more question, then I'm going to turn it over to Robert. I think it was back in 2017, Councilman Willie Bradford was speaking to a group of businessmen, and he made the comment that blacks make up more than 80% of the region population, but they still receive less than 10% of city contracts. Now, do you agree with his statement or not?
That they receive less than 10%?
Yes.
So, to my knowledge, it's less than 0.5% that actually goes to African Americans. The 10% number, I believe, includes the businessmen who transferred their company's ownership over into their wives' names so that they could beat it, because the Fair Share Act includes, you know, women and minority-owned businesses. So when we're talking about just African Americans in a city that is well over 50%, I think it's actually closer to 60 or 64% African Americans, black folks getting contracts, to my knowledge, is actually it's less than 1%. I'm almost certain by the most recent numbers. So I guess the answer to the question is I agree, but with those minor corrections.
I can't think of my name.
I'm sorry, there was some interference, James. I didn't hear the last part of your statement.
I was just saying that I believe I agree with the premise of what he's saying. Just the statistics themselves, I believe, are far more dire than what he expressed last year.
Okay, so you agree that minorities are being overlooked when it comes to city contracts?
Right, I don't know what the process is for with any certainty. What I do know is that my time involved in the contracting business, that the same people get the contracts every time, and they're typically what I would call a paper contractor. There's somebody who's going to be in the loop, and they're going to get the contract whether or not they change their business name over into their wife's name, or went out and got a, you know, Hispanic, you know, business partner, whatever the case may be. For their, you know, I don't know what's in the hearts of people making the decisions. What I know is that the end product is unacceptable. The end product is unacceptable if a city upwards of 64% African Americans make up less than 1% of the city contracts. You know,
right.
To further go into that, just know where my heart is on that particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
Those contracts should also be staying in Shreveport. We shouldn't be bringing in out of town paper contractors who are going to then subcontract it out. You know, where three or four people are making a piece of the pie before some out of towners are going to come in and work for a couple of weeks and then leave town with all of our money.
Okay. Robert?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to turn it over to you and let you go ahead and ask your questions.
Okay, well, one of the most important things that we have to tie in into the Fair Share program is the disparity, a disparity report. Mr. Carson, can you explain to the audience what the disparity report is, and why is that so important to helping us actually make sure that the Fair Share program is fair? And do you agree that we need a disparity report here in Shreveport and Caddo Parish?
Hey, to answer the last part of the question first, absolutely yes. The reason that we need that disparity study, the most important part is, other than it proving the obvious and the things that most of us are already aware of. I mean, like I spoke with Mr. Scott, the the fact that we have a city that is, you know, upwards of 64% African Americans, and they receive less than 1% of the total contract. We know that, you know, the statistics are there. The study comes in and goes much deeper on that level. But the biggest and most important part that we fail to see, even Mr. Bradford and other advocates who are, you know, very pro, you know, they're for the disparity study, which we all should be, because the number one thing it does is it once you have the study, the proof has been done, you know, the proof has been made. That's how you get qualified for the federal grant funding that you can use to actually implement solutions. So instead of, you know, harping and campaigning and, you know, standing up, looking like the hero in front of your people, you know, championing, you know, these rhetorical talking points, we can actually get to solutions, and we can get help funding those solutions, and we can begin to talk about solving the problems. You know, anybody can get up there. Anybody can get elected to city council. Anybody can go stand in there and identify problems. We all know what the problems are. We live in the same city. We walk the same streets. You know, we eat at the same restaurants. We suffer. You know, we suffer the same poverty. We suffer from the same horrible streets. We suffer from the same crime problems. All right. We need to vote. We need to fully fund the disparity study at first. I believe they gave $150,000. They did eventually vote on when it was estimated to be $300,000, maybe $400,000, which seems like a lot of money. But I mean, you know, we have almost a $500 million a year annual budget when cities our size and same demographic, you know, and overall, you know, geography are spending less than half of that on their annual budgets. You know, there's clearly misuse, abuse, and fraud, and just inefficiency and wasteful spending all over the place. So for us to act like we don't have money for something that's so important to the people, the people who are struggling the most in this city, you know, with some of the lowest quality of life, those are the things that we need to address. Because when we do that and we bring up the lowest and we improve quality of life for everyone in Shreveport, really, and that's why I believe the disparity study is so important, because it moves us past talking about the problem. We establish the problem in black and white, but mainly we get the opportunity to get the money from federal grants that allow us to actually pursue solutions. And that's what I'm all about, solutions, not complaining about problems.
Well, then I just want to ask one question after that statement, Rob. So you would disagree with what Councilman, I think it was John Atkins, who said that a disparity study is one poor use of money.
Yeah, I mean, he probably doesn't understand that. I mean, to be completely honest, I've been attending these meetings for years. You know, I've been involved in trying to help our leaders, you know, understand, you know, exactly what their responsibilities are and what our expectations are as people. You know, I've kind of been doing the city councilman's job as a citizen, if you will. Yeah, Commissioner Atkins is probably just one of the many people sitting on, you know, in office in these types of scenarios that don't actually know the enough details to form an opinion. Let's put it that way. I'm not going to say he doesn't know anything about it, because he's a very smart guy. And, you know, I'm sure he's done lots of other things that are great. But in this particular situation, he, like most of the people who I've heard speak on the issue, are completely unaware of the details and the reasoning behind it, you know. Unless he just outright disagrees that, you know, that less than 1% of African Americans getting city contracts is a bad idea. Now, the parish doesn't do a whole lot of work. Maybe that's what Mr. Atkins did, because he's actually a Caddo commissioner. Maybe his statement was based on that they just don't contract enough work out. Maybe the demographics are completely different for the parish. I'm not certain. So, I mean, in his defense, I will leave that out there. Maybe that's what he meant. Like I've said before, I can't tell you what's in the heart of others, but when it comes to this city,
exactly.
You know, our city council, the demographics in this city, less than 1% of all city contracts go into African Americans is absolutely unacceptable. We need to move past that. We need to do the disparity study, have it in proof, you know, have the proof black and white, apply for funding, begin talking about solutions. Let's get to solving the problems instead of just playing musical chairs with electing the, you know, the next man up, the one who's put in the work, the next familiar face and popular name, or the biggest spender.
Okay. Robert?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, being that you feel that we do need this disparity study, which, of course, it's a no-brainer, you know. I would take odds against anybody who thought otherwise. But let's go on because we're going to be running short of time. We know, again, the problem about crime here in Shreveport. Let's talk about what you would do if you were able to get into that office. What would you do to make the crime, to particularly help to reduce the amount of crime that we're experiencing here in Shreveport?
Everybody loves crime. I have a lot of ideas. Some are a little bigger than others and may almost seem like a pipe dream at times. I do believe that there needs to be an emphasis on better pay, which seems like a common thing. It's not just the only thing, and it's not a real popular thing among, you know, a lot of people, but the police do need they do need better pay so we can attract better police. Then they need better training. We need better funding for them. So one of the biggest plans I would like to see is this ginormous, I believe it's a, you know, $9 million a year budget item that created what I like to call the racket of the SPD's pension plan. I have some, you know, insider information. You know, I'm talking captain levels and, you know, retired captains and people, you know, in the police department high up. I actually have the lieutenant chief of police verbatim, his exact quotes explaining that for 10 years now we've been paying, or this is the ninth, or I think the 10th year, I think it's almost 10 years in on this new retirement pension, which by their own proclamations is the number one most lucrative pension plan any law enforcement department in the entire United States. Let that sink in for a moment. We have the most lucrative pension plan. And the reason that they, you know, allegedly created this, you know, massive pension plan was because they wanted to retain those officers. Because what happens, good cops get trained. They go on the field for 6, 12, 18 months. They hit their numbers for their $6,000 a year subsidy from the state. And then they go work for a, you know, small town police station somewhere or anywhere in East Texas or Stonewall, Blanchard, Benton, where they, you know, could be making a minimum of like $14,000 more per year. So we lose our good cops, and the only ones we retain are the ones that are hanging on waiting for that lucrative pension, typically behind desk and not out there on the floor. Having 120 officers out of, you know, the 580 they claim it sometimes and want to have, I think it's actually around 520 right now, but they can't put 120 to 150 at the absolute most on the streets for, you know, for an entire city, where there's times at night from 9 o'clock at night till 5 o'clock in the morning, they might have 1 to 3 officers at the most patrolling one of the largest districts, or a supervisor, for instance, who made a comment on a Facebook thread I saw and snapped a screenshot of. He explains that lights on, sirens on, in the middle of the night from one call to another, one end of his stretch to the other is a 20-minute drive. A lot can happen in 20 minutes when you're being robbed, shot, you know, raped.
Exactly.
You know, your car's being burglarized. It's absolutely unacceptable. So we have to really – I mean, there's a lot of reasons we need to reform law enforcement in general. But the overall policies, the things that we're doing and the way that we're handling our manpower, it absolutely must change. But that's going to take those caveats. You know, we're not going to be able to retain our police, and we're going to continue to hemorrhage the money that we do have in training new cops who are just going to continue to leave after 1.5 to 2 years on the job. And that costs us a huge amount of money, and it keeps our department getting older and older and more out of touch with reality. And they're not on the streets. They don't know the people. They don't know the actual issues we have. You know, those 120 cops that are out there on the streets, a lot of them are doing a good job. they're just simply understaffed, they're underpaid, and they're undertrained. So pulling money out of this absurd pension plan that has done absolutely nothing. I forgot to mention that in his numbers, it shows that the numbers go up, the percentage has not changed. The same amount of police are getting trained and leaving or retiring, but leaving the department to work for somewhere else. Their retention is the same. It has not changed. As we've grown from, you know, a 200-plus officer department to over 500, the percentage is the same. We lose 30-plus cops a year right now out of the 500, which means the numbers are the same. The people are leaving at the same rate. That super number one most lucrative in the entire country pension plan isn't doing a thing to retain the good officers that we have. So they're leaving faster than we can train them, and we're just hemorrhaging money. Throwing good money at bad has never solved anyone's problems. We have to start with the overall reform. We need to draw that money out and put it directly into pay raises, training, equipment, and potentially a new facility, you know?
Yeah. So, we're moving fast. We're going to be moving a little bit fast because of time.
Okay.
Let's go to education. We know that education here in Caddo Parish pretty much, I'm just keeping it real, pretty much sucks. You have a lot of school closings. You have a lot of schools that are failing. What do you feel that the city could do? And if you was able to get that spot, what could you do from the point of view of the city to work better with the parish to make sure that we start using some of the facilities more better, make sure we start using the resources that we can get from the parish? How would you go out what would you do about that?
Well, as a city councilman, being a representative of the people, there's not a whole lot that you can do from city council as when it pertains to education, because it is more of a parish thing, and the school board is kind of like their own government within. However, mm-hmm. that being said, the city council does still write all the rules for everything that goes on inside of these city limits. So there is an opportunity where if we can, you know, cut back on a lot of this wasteful spending and create things and stop giving ludicrous tax exemptions to certain big companies that aren't doing anything for our economy and they're not creating jobs and are not, you know, improving the overall quality of life of anyone in Shreveport. And all of a sudden we have a whole lot more money. And if we have a whole lot more money, we could even go as far as in the future. I'm not sure this is something that could happen in a 4-year time span, but it would be cool to go out there to advocate, you know, and to champion universal pre-K, mm-hmm. especially for underprivileged. We may not be able to fund it directly or in its totality, but we could certainly help start and create like a pilot, or to say, hey, you know, we've slashed spending. I mean, like I said before, I've researched a couple of cities that are, you know, the same demographic and the same overall geography, the same kind of size. And the highest annual budget is $225 million. We're spending almost $500. So we're more than double any other city in the country that is, you know, relatively comparable in size and demographic and spending. So if we're able to, you know, really hark down and get rid of a lot of this this good old boy system and what some people may think is just, you know, outright corruption, there's a lot of money that's there, and that lot of money could potentially go. I know we can fund things that are after school programs, which would certainly help, especially with our youth. But I keep wanting to go back to the universal pre-K, because, you know, having young children myself and being lucky and being blessed by a disaster losing everything was the reason that, you know, provided me with the opportunity to get my kids into a pre-K program. One of my children tested in and was able to, you know, get the rest of my kids into a pre-K program, starting school a little earlier, that not only helped me as a parent, a single parent, especially a dad of all girls, but it helped my kids kind of catch up. And if anything, going to a really great school, I mean, they're really at the top of their class now. And I think that has a lot to do. Sure, I would love to take all the credit and pat myself on the back for, you know, just being dad of the year, you know, almighty, you know, just best dad ever. But I know that really helped with my kids in general, and I would love to see a way that we could potentially, you know, redirect some funds. A lot of this money that we could save, I mean, we could potentially reduce taxes and still have a surplus of money left over that we could fund after school programs and incentivize, you know, schools or maybe pay teachers more to pay for the universal pre-K. And if not, you know, all together in all the schools, at least target a few special schools that are in neighborhoods that are, you know, normally underserved, you know, where kids are typically where testing scores are just historically lower, you know, where they struggle more. Because I know through a bunch of parenting classes I took, obviously, you know, waking up one day as a single dad, I went out to learn as much as I could. And I know that children, you know, in the first 4 to 5 years of their life is the most influential times in their life. So we can literally help to shape children's lives and their future in situations where when they have either, you know, single parent households or dual parents working, when, you know, like I said before, we might be working two or three jobs just to be broke at the end of the day. And that doesn't leave a lot of time to be a parent, especially not a single parent. You know, it really, really would help, I think, a lot if we could. I know, again, that may be looked at as kind of a thing beyond the scope of the city council, but I certainly believe that if we were to bring our overall budget, our annual budget, you know, down 40-50%, all of a sudden we have a huge pile of money, a lot like what Caddo Parish has. Because Caddo Parish has got the money to do these things. They're just not being pressured by the people because we're all too busy working, and all their meetings are at 3 o'clock on weekdays when we're working or in, you know, picking our kids up from school. That's another thing I want to change. I think I talked to Robert about that, you know, was about, you know, having a Saturday meeting or a, you know, 6 o'clock in the evening meeting once a month that would allow other people and to get them more engaged.
Yeah, you and I talked about that. We had talked about that. I believe this city council is there for a time. I mean, at the time that it is for that reason. But anyway, go ahead, Alfonso. You go ahead and take over for me. Cause I think you're running out of time.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I know we are running out of time today. We're having to cut the show short today, and I apologize, but I have to meet with some people downtown to discuss the police officer that shot and killed 26-year-old Botman Gene. But a young lady contacted me the other night, James, and you and I spoke about it, but because I was not able to verify what she told me was happening, that part of the story I won't bring up. But when she heard that Robert and I was going to be interviewing you today, she asked me to ask you about homelessness in Shreveport. Someone once said that homelessness is a choice, and I totally disagree with that. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, well, hey, I want to be homeless. And also, I'm a firm believer that not everybody homeless is an alcoholic or is on drugs. Sometimes it's just L-I-F-E. But that is a problem in Shreveport, especially with the homelessness hanging out downtown. And, you know, we have the Shreveport Bossier Rescue Mission, and they're there to help. And I just want your views on what can we do to help the homelessness, help themselves, and you know, get back to living again.
Right, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. I'd recently talked about the Hope Connection is another thing that we have. It is right on the outsides of downtown. It was just built brand new over there off of Levy Street, coming right off of Texas Avenue. So it's just outside of downtown. But I know that they were there was people that were off around passing out little cards, you know, that were like bus passes where they could catch a bus ride over there. It is a place where they can get meals, showers, you know, get shaved up and, you know, training for certain things. Those would be the people that would be interested, you know. I know that when some people say that they think that homelessness is a choice, that may be true in some situations, but it's certainly not always. You know, I certainly never planned, you know, for my home to be destroyed in a natural disaster and, you know, have insurance not prepared to pay out and just wake up homeless. I mean, that was certainly not a choice. And
exactly.
having lived that and experienced it and trying to navigate away and the things looking for help, it's not as easy as one would seem. You know, you spend your whole life, you know, with a silver spoon in your mouth or whatnot. And unless you've lived it, then you don't really understand the the things that are there. But as for me, I would like to promote things like the Hope Connection and potentially, you know, maybe draw back on some regulations about some of the things that I've heard. I'm not 100% certain on whether or not they said that feeding the homeless downtown is illegal, is what somebody told me and was asking me if I would repeal that. And I was like, I don't really know. I don't know if that's a factual statement or not. I certainly hope it's not. Otherwise, that's a law that I've been breaking, because me and my kids go out and, you know, we raise money and buy meals from one charity group who's raising money for one charity, and then we go give the meals out to people just asking them if they're hungry, just driving around. Hey, man, you hungry? Hey, you know, Jesus loves you. And moving on, you know, that's something that I do, and, you know, that would be illegal. I would certainly like to see it as a city that we're not stopping volunteerism, you know. If people, churches and groups and people that want to do things and help, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And I know that right. may ruffle some feathers, because there's people in this city that have been, you know, trying to lead this city from positions, you know, outside of power or with other specific committees. And, you know, they have more persuasion and pull. And, you know, they may not like the things that I'm saying. But, you know, I like I've said before, I'm not really trying to make friends. You know, I'm trying to solve problems. And exactly. I would like to review to make sure that there's if there are laws like that we don't need to revisit those and make amendments to those and spend more time trying to help people and trying to improve the overall quality of life, the amount of opportunities and the programs, and incentivize, you know, nonprofits and even for-profit businesses that are, you know, implementing programs that are going to help them. You know, if they have an apprenticeship or a mentorship program or something, you know, within their company, something they're doing, we should find ways to incentivize them and, you know, really kind of give these companies a pat on the back. Doing things like that, I think would help a whole lot better than trying to alienate the homeless and trying to, you know, force mm-hmm. them to one side of town or to get them out of downtown. And the other thing we talked about was, you know, trying to fund a public bathroom downtown, so at least we don't have to, you know, worry about business owners having to, you know, clean up human feces in front of the doors of their buildings. I understand that would be a major problem. And it sounds like I'm wanting to spend some money again. But, I mean, there's a time to spend money, and then there's a time to be, you know, fiscally responsible. And I think a town our size could really stand to have a public bathroom in its downtown, you know, at least a place that's not going to turn somebody away at the door and be like, no, sir, you know, you look homeless and dirty. You're not allowed to come in our building and use the bathroom. You know what I mean?
Right.
You're not exactly giving them choices and opportunities. But to get back to it, I'm sorry I keep running you guys late on time, because you're actually talking about a few things that I'm a bit passionate about, and I have a lot of solutions for. So
no, that's good. That's good. You're on the show because I believe you had some things that our listeners needed to hear, and so we do thank you for that. We thank you for your honesty. And what I'm going to ask now is, since we're first week or sometime in the near future, if you would come back on our show again, we can finish with this show and maybe add some things to it that we didn't get a chance to talk about today. But before
Absolutely.
We do, thank you. I want to ask you about the neighborhoods that are within your district. So those that are listening and who know who they need to contact when, if they're in a certain neighborhood. Because you have a pretty big area to cover.
I do have a pretty big area. You know, the whole town being broken down into seven districts leaves you with, you know, anywhere between 18,500 and 22,000 citizens in your district. District B does encompass all of downtown. And going south from there along the river, it's going to include, you know, half of Anderson Island, all of Stoner Hill and Highland, basically up to about King's Highway, all the way down to around Gilbert, where that new Circle K was built. It's going to include about half of South Highland there. But on the west, going west from downtown, well, it's along roughly like it takes a piece of Ingleside and Allendale up to about Hearn Avenue. Following along Hearn Avenue all the way to where it turns into Mansfield Road. So it includes a little piece of Queensboro, you know, all the Midway. We're talking Caddo Heights, south, or no, wait a minute, that would be north, northeast Cedar Grove, a little bit of Sunset Acres, Midway. I think I hope I'm probably leaving somebody out because I know we do have about 17 neighborhoods in there. But that pretty much rubs up the geography there for the west side of 49 and the east side.
Okay, one last question. What is it that you think is imperative that you would like to tackle first if you would be elected to that seat?
This may not be a very popular answer, but I really, really want to get in there. And I want to increase the engagement with the public. I want to get in there and I want to change. See, the first thing that we do is we go in that first Monday after being elected, we meet together, and by our own charter, that's when we determine when, you know, when the meetings are and what our schedule is going to be like and how we're going to meet that, you know, twice a month. It doesn't have to be at 3 o'clock. We can change that. It's just never been done. Everybody's like, well, it's just the way it's always been done. I want to get in there and I would really like to advocate a Saturday meeting once a month. That way, basically, that essentially means that nothing can get pushed through the city council without being read. And everything has to be read twice, right, before they can vote on it. It has to go through a first reading and then again a second reading 2 weeks later. So even when they're trying to rush things through, they still have to read it twice. So they can go ahead and read it at 3 o'clock when nobody's in there and nobody can be there, and they can rush something through, and then we're all like, man, what happened? Where did this come from? Or why am I, you know, paying this? And why are all these things changing? And things are getting worse.
Exactly.
People are making bad decisions.
All right.
If we get in there and we make at least one of those meetings be on a Saturday, or potentially, you know, maybe it's have a meeting at 6 o'clock in the evening on for the one meeting, and then the second meeting be on a Saturday, we're opening up the door, creating the opportunity. That does two things. One, it is an actual opportunity to increase engagement, to allow all, you know, to at least allow a much broader scope of our citizens to have their voice heard. But it also shows that picture that, hey, you know what? You went out and you elected James Carstensen, candidate number 80. You know, you went out there and you elected him, and he went in there and he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And now we have a council that cares. These people are actually listening. He didn't just talk about it and then it disappear. We created the opportunity so the people will see that. It's like, oh, wow, city council is meeting on Saturdays once a month now? Man, they actually care about what the people think. That can change the overall image. When people are having their voices heard and they feel like they're able to give their input and their input is used and their representatives that they're electing are actually out there representing them, That changes your feel. That can instill pride in people. All of a sudden, where you know people lower their head, you know, say, "Hey man, where are you from?" I'll say, "Hey man, I'm from Shreveport." No, they lower their head and like, "Oh man, you know, I'm from Northwest Louisiana." You know, man, now I'm just you know, up there. You know, I'm from Ratchet City, or you know, trying to make fun of the situation to make light of it. You begin to change that stigma. And people, having more people involved. You know, they always say the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? So the people that can afford to take time off work, get to those meetings, those are the ones who are having their problems addressed. You're saying...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I keep running on, man.
No. You schooled me, though. I just want to tell you that you just schooled me because I was like most people. I thought, well, 3 o'clock, that's just the way it is. But it always bothered me because when I'm looking at it, I mean, it may be 10 or 15 people there, and I'm like, I know it should be more people than that there, but the timing is wrong. But I thought that's the way it was and the way it has to be. So I didn't know y'all could change that either.
The city council can change anything. We're under a home rule charter. There is no law. When they tell you that state law, you know, has their hands tied, it's because they don't want to do anything and they don't respect your intelligence. The fact is that the city council is the legislators for this city. And the things that go on in this city, we can change the laws and how state laws will be enforced on our people. If the sheriff wants to come in and try to overrule the city, they can have that battle another day. But overall, the city makes the rules and they can rewrite them any way they so choose. They may not get reelected for it, and the next guys may come in and change it back.
Right.
We certainly have the power. We just have to have the right people in position.
Well, if you are elected, will you have an open door policy, or can they reach you anytime? Like when Ashley called me the other night. She found out she was going to be on the show. Someone, you know, who is homeless, will they be able to call you and talk to you on different issues, you know, that are bothering them? Or will it be like most of individuals into politics? We say yes, but when we get there, no, I'm too busy.
Right. No, my personal cell phone number is already a matter of public record. I put it on there the day that I qualified. For the last couple of years, I've been going to, you know, all the city council meetings anyways. And there's been times where I've had people, they've complained, or I've seen them on Facebook threads complaining about how they can't go have their voice heard. It's too bill time. I've had them send me emails, you know, write me a letter. And I'll go in there and I'll use my 3 minutes of public speaking time to read their letters. You know what I mean? I've always had an open policy. You know, I typically have a very private life. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, my cell phone number's out there. People know where I live. People know where I work. People know where I eat. People know where my phone number is. And I love people, man. You know, I mean, that's something that was instilled in me. It's just a part of who I am. I love people, and I want to help people. I am a problem solver. So my cell phone number's been the same for, you know, I don't know, 20 years, however long have we had cell phones now. It hasn't changed. It's public record.
Okay.
My website has contact me services where you can email me and it goes straight to my cell phone. You can email me from my website at jamescarstensen.com, and I can call you today. You know, I can answer your questions now. I can meet you at your neighborhood meeting. I can come over and just meet some of your friends in your home, in your neighborhood, and let you ask me questions on a one-on-one basis, or, you know, a four-on-one. You know, whatever it is, and that's not going to change. You know, I'm the same man that I was. I'm the same man that I was raised to be, and I'm always going to be the same man that I am.
As always, we do thank you all for listening to the show today. We've been listening to James Cardison, who is running for District B in Shreveport, Louisiana. We also spoke a little today about Dallas Police Officer Amber Geyer, and we'll be discussing more of her later today, and we'll keep you with live updates on that story as well. And Robert R. Thomas Jr. Was with us today from the Real News Behind the News. Robert, I always thank you for coming on the show with me there. It's always a pleasure to have you, and the voice needs to be heard, and I appreciate the things that you're doing in the community as well. And James, you have a kind spirit, a kind heart, and it was a blessing to have you come on.
I thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir, you are welcome. You've been listening to Injustice Investigations. Remember, I'm not always right, and you are not always wrong. Be it the Lord willing, we'll see you next Wednesday at 1 p.m. Until then, I'm Al Scott.
Y'all be blessed.
Thanks again for having me, guys.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you. Y'all probably be blessed.